Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to Sparks. This week, we interview Peter Chicago, a man who needs no introduction. Alan Sugar wants a consumer video phone for £500. Can Amstrad and GEC Marconi make it practical? We look at hospital radio on FM, chart fiddling, and Powell Plus, a new TV standard that could lead Europe towards high-definition television. We've had a letter from the DTI, and of course lots of letters from you. So keep them coming, and listen to Sparks on Radio Facts. A letter from M. Keenan. in Cosham, Portsmouth, in Hampshire. He writes, I've been an occasional listener to your broadcasts for a few years now. My first log of radio facts was in December 1988. On that occasion, I believe you closed down on the 30th of that month. I like your mix of music and media news on Sparks. Keep up the good work. Thanks to M. Keenan, who listens on a low HF225 long wire antenna.
Terrestrial Euro Television heads for PAL Plus. In international broadcasting by Orlando Kimber. The Eureka 95 committee has inaugurated a project to make PAL Plus the natural precursor to terrestrial high-definition television in Europe. Introducing customers weaned on PAL to the 16:9 widescreen format ahead of a solid high-definition television standard. Announced at the Eureka Ministerial Conference in The Hague in June, Eureka Project 637 aims to enhance the PAL standard for terrestrial transmission. The committee wants to commence broadcasting in 1995 with a single system using a common technology requiring component video production for the whole of Europe. Although PAL Plus transmits a composite signal, component production is needed because the clean colour signals aid the image interpolation process. PAL Plus will marry the 16:9 widescreen aspect ratio picture image to the existing PAL format, improve picture resolution and sound quality, and reduce the cross-colour and cross-luminance artifacts of the present system, whilst maintaining compatibility with the installed base of PAL sets that prevail in Europe. The Eureka 95 committee comprises many European broadcasters and is supported by Thomson, Philips, Grundig and Nokia. It sees the standard stimulating the market for 16:9 consumer television and drawing Europe closer towards the ultimate goal of high-definition television. Consumer-friendly widescreen sets should be available by the end of the decade, with pundits predicting the appearance of flat-screen displays by that time. Meanwhile, the most optimistic forecasts of a standard for digital television are from the United States, with 1995 penciled in. With these constraints and the prevailing confusion caused by the fact that the technology is developing faster than standards are set, observers say European broadcasters would be wise to stick to developing widescreen compatible program material, shot on 35mm film, or perhaps 1250 line Eureka 256 equipment when available. They say that any moves other than investigating the inevitable simulcast demands and coding for pay television in the transitionary period between PAL and high definition could prove a very costly error and best covered by encouragement either from the nation states or Eureka itself. That report in International Broadcasting.
Heart Attack Early Warning System in Electronics Weekly. Scientists at a US university have developed a fiber optic sensor which can detect levels of various components of blood flowing in an artery. The team at Tufts University in Massachusetts believe the sensor could give surgeons early warning of heart attacks. The hair-thin fiber can be threaded into the artery to analyze the blood without having to take a sample out of the body. This reduces the chance of contamination of the blood. The sensor consists of a single fiber with specks of an indicator chemical on its tip. The light beam passes out of the fiber through the chemical dyes. The strength of the beam leaving the tip depends on the levels of various chemicals in the blood.
In the rain, and there was love, 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 love. Anyone
Trevor has been down to the Kent coast to see Peter Chicago, chief engineer on Radio North Sea International in the 1970s, and then, of course, Radio Caroline until the present day. Here is his interview.
Right, Peter, it's a warm, sunny day, and it's a flat calm out there. Would you rather be out on that boat instead of ashore here?
Providing I could get back in the evening, I think the boat's a great place to be during the day and to get away from it all. But it is nice to be able to go ashore and have a drink and have the comforts of home at the same time.
So the pleasures of being on a radio ship, you've had enough of?
I think so. It's the sort of thing that it's a novelty at first, and then as the years go by, it becomes more and more of a chore. And at the moment, I enjoy going out to the boat to do a particular job or possibly just to get away from things for a little while, but not something that I want to go on doing long term.
And how is the boat?
At the moment, the boat's very good. Cosmetically anyway, because it has been a good summer. There's been quite a few people out there, and with the boat not broadcasting, there's been plenty of opportunity to get the painting details that have engaged. There's been a lot of painting outside and inside as well. The hull is still in very good condition as far as we can tell. There are problems. The anchor chain's been out there a long time now, and it's probably about time that we got round to at least providing a sensible backup chain in case it does break. But in general, the boat is in very good condition.
And what sort of condition is all the radio equipment in?
Well, I was out there just a week ago now, and the transmitter room's been completely cleaned up. It was quite a pleasant surprise to me to go down there and see the work that's gone into really clearing away a lot of the old rubbish and putting things in order. As far as I can tell, the transmitters are in virtually the same condition they were when we ceased broadcasting, which is just about a year ago now.
So, where do you fall in the ideas for the future of Caroline? The group seems to be split between those who want to see it go legal, come ashore, and those who say it isn't Caroline if it's not on a boat.
I would love to be part of a Radio Caroline station that was licensed and a legitimate UK commercial radio station, but it would have to be with the freedom to provide our own kind of programming and with enough financial independence that we weren't being dictated to by a group of businessmen with no interest or knowledge of radio. If we could have an ideal kind of situation, then I would love to see a licensed Radio Caroline broadcasting from the mainland UK. I think realistically, though, the best chance of having Caroline back on the air in the way that most of the listeners would remember it is through means of a so-called third world license, where we would be licensed by some small country well outside Europe, and we would be licensed by them to transmit effectively an overseas service for that country, and at the same time would be broadcasting the regular Caroline programs as well.
Yeah, presumably that's the only way you'd ever be on the air covering a reasonable area. If you came ashore in the UK, you're not going to have any sort of significant coverage.
Well, the best proposition that has been offered to us is the opportunity of putting in a bid for an IBA station for Greater London. Now, that would give us a fairly large area, probably most of the areas that were effectively covered from the ship. But of course, the broadcast from the ship did go much further afield, and we couldn't hope for that kind of coverage with a local IBA license.
You could use it, though, as a basis for a program service to put on satellite, perhaps. Do you see the future there?
My hope would be that if Caroline did obtain an IBA license, that eventually we would be putting out satellite programming in parallel with the more localized broadcast, so that we would, to some extent, get the best of both worlds. We would be covering a European area with the satellite broadcasts, albeit with a much less concentrated audience, and at the same time probably gaining our financial operating capital from the medium wave service, which would be the Greater London service, perhaps.
So is anything active happening in the direction of something licensed by the Radio Authority?
Well, so far the Greater London frequency hasn't been advertised, so it's a bit premature to actually talk about applying for it. We have been led to believe that such a station will be created and the franchise will be advertised, and probably that will happen early next year. But to some extent that's speculative.
And will all the people involved in Caroline stick together and apply for it? Or do you think that there'll be dissent and a lot of people would rather not get involved and stay offshore?
I think the more time goes by, the more of the Caroline following, perhaps, that they will be prepared to accept a less than ideal solution. I think at the moment the main hope is still to obtain a so-called third world license and to broadcast again from the high seas. But as I say, as more time goes by, I think perhaps people will begin perhaps to lose hope in that idea, and they've become more interested in any other options that perhaps might be more realistic.
Do you think there's much chance yourself in a third world license?
Well, at the moment we've actually been offered such a license, and the license has a price, and I think it comes back to the usual problem that anything is possible if the money is there to do it. We've always had to make do with limited finances, and if we are to get a third world license, it's going to be on the basis of a negotiated agreement, perhaps for profit sharing, perhaps just for publicising the country concerned. But the difficulty is in arriving at such a negotiated settlement. The country concerned want cash for the licence.
And what sort of money is this? Is it totally out of the question, or is there some chance that there might be a wealthy pop star who feels enough sentiment for Caroline that they become involved and stump up the money as a gesture?
Well, I don't know the exact amount involved. I have the feeling that it's between £250,000 and £300,000. So far, we haven't found any benevolent pop stars or any other business person willing to write out a cheque for that amount.
Slightly less, perhaps, than you pay to buy a national independent radio franchise, but still an awful lot of money.
Well, that's the way it was put to us.
Yeah.
It was put to us as being a good deal, as you say, less than it would pay perhaps to get an independent radio license or franchise, but still more money than we can actually afford at the moment.
With no foreseeable source of income.
But, as I say, our main hopes at the moment are in negotiating the required license, and perhaps on the basis of a profit-sharing scheme which the country involved might just be prepared to go for.
Peter Chicago, interviewed by Trevor Brook. Those of you who follow Radio Caroline closely will probably already know that just about the only source of income Peter has these days is a premium rate telephone line, 0836 404 565. There's also a question line for you to record questions for Peter on 0836 404 566. These lines are charged at 45p peak rate and 36p at all other times. I'll repeat the numbers in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be fair? Wouldn't that be fair? baby, 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 baby.
So Peter Chicago's phone lines again, 0836 404 565 for a general information line, and 0836 404 566 for a specific question to be answered by Peter, a 45 pence peak and 36p at all other times. While you've got your pencil and paper out, you might like to note down that Radio Netherlands have just published their latest book list. One typical entry, Pirate Radio Stations 1991. Quite interesting. Edited by Michael Ravenier. The address 21 Rue de la Chatterie, F08160, Hanogue Saint-Martin in France. And for 60 francs plus 10 francs postage in Europe, a list of hobby stations heard on shortwave and medium wave, listed by frequency and station order. Lists more than 500 operations with addresses, power, language and phone numbers. Ideal for hobbyists. Interesting book list, and you can get that free. No need to send even any international reply coupons, aren't they generous? To Radio Netherlands, P.O. Box 222, 1200 JG, Hilversum, the Netherlands. Their fax number is 31 07573-724352. And while you're dropping a line to them, we always appreciate your letters as well. It's Sparks on Radio Fax. Unfortunately, we're slightly poorer than Radio Netherlands, so if you'd like a reply to your letter that includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, we'd appreciate if you sent 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG. Fresh Radio Fax programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. And Sparks this week is presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. And thanks very much to Tapio Salmiavi, writing from Finland, Tampere to be exact. He's a 46-year-old technician and he listens on an NRD-535D with a 30-metre-long dipole antenna. Thank you for your interesting programme. In the old days, I was a keen listener to Radio Caroline. Now I like your programmes as well. Please indicate if you broadcast on a legal permit or not. Very best wishes. Well, our position is we are in Ireland and we don't have a licence. However, we would like one. We'd like to transmit from Britain because the shortwave signal would be much stronger. And we don't think that the BBC should be the only people who are licensed in this country to broadcast on shortwave. So if you agree with us, you might like to drop a line to your MP.
This is an interesting letter about the way in which the record charts are fiddled. It's in Private Eye. Dear Sir, in your Popeye article, you allude to sales assistants in record shops keying the wrong numbers into Gallup chart computers. In the majority of cases, this is not so, since the machines are fitted with barcode readers. This means the computer registers the correct record number, or it registers nothing at all. However, the sales representatives of many of the major distributors offer you free product, unmarked. Most free product is marked promotional copy, not for resale, under normal circumstances. On the condition, that's this unmarked promotional material, on the condition that you register it on the Gallup machine there and then. Most often, it is all on different formats, 7-inch, 12-inch, cassette single, CD single, various remixes, which all have different numbers, but register as the same piece of music. This avoids suspicious-looking bunching of the same number at one time. While working in a shop with a chart machine, I could not throw a Bob Dylan album without hitting 3 record company representatives. But on being moved to a different shop without a Gallup computer, I never saw one. Yours faithfully, Roy Hunter, Glasgow. A letter in Private Eye about the way the record charts are compiled.
I fell in love with you. The stars above us and we're clean out of reach of my chains. Oh, the chains that were killing me. You make everything a paradise. Paradise with you is twice as nice. Never change. Never change what you're doing to me.
You're listening to Radio Facts, and it's Sparks, every Monday and Tuesday, our weekly programme of science and technology news and features. From Electronics Weekly, sugar pins hopes on a consumer video phone. Amstrad's chairman thinks the video phone could become the next great consumer product. Richard Wilson reports. Amstrad, the consumer electronics innovator, created a minor shockwave in the telecommunications industry last month with its plans for a £500 video phone. Video compression specialists have developed desktop video phones. International digital compressed data rate standards are agreed, and a pan-European business service is planned. Amstrad's chairman, Alan Sugar, has ignored all that. He is not interested in a £2,000 business video phone, which will work over a few tens of thousands of digital telephone lines. With the help of GEC Marconi, he intends to create a consumer product which will work on every analog telephone line in Britain. The video phone could become the next great consumer electronics product, says Sugar. Has Sugar found another entry-level electronics product, just as he did with the PC 10 years ago, or has he misjudged the complexities of video telephony? The main issue is how much picture information can be transmitted over the telephone line. Broadcast quality video can be compressed onto 264 kilobit per second digital ISDN telephone channels. A data compression algorithm achieves this by reading the digitally coded picture data and then only transmits the information which records when elements or pixels of the picture change. In this way, the picture is not continually redrawn, only modified to accommodate movement. British Telecom researchers have developed a video phone which will operate using a single 64 kilobit per second ISDN channel. The video data is compressed into 46.4 kilobits per second and the audio into 16 kilobits a second, and the rest is control signal. Martin Redstall, head of the British Telecom Videophone Group, says the videophone will have a quarter of the definition of a full video conferencing system costing £20,000. A videophone uses a small screen, up to 6-inch diagonal, so there is no point in going overboard on the resolution, he says. The important thing is that the angle subtended to the eye should be kept small. BT, along with other European operators and manufacturers, believes the 64 kilobit per second video phone is principally a business product, which will sell as ISDN connections become more widely available. BT and six European operators are planning a pan-European video phone service for 1993. None of that interests Alan Sugar at Amstrad. 50,000 ISDN lines in the UK is not a big enough market. Sugar wants a video phone which can be used on Britain's 24 million analog telephone lines, and GEC Marconi has told him it's possible. Last month, the two companies announced their intention to launch a consumer video phone in 12 months. GEC Marconi's sister company, GPT, which manufactures the BT video conferencing codec under license, is understood to have developed a new compression algorithm, which enables a video phone picture to be transmitted at 9.6 kilobits per second. Kevin Waterhouse, marketing director at GPT Video and Data Systems, says the new codec, which has already been demonstrated to Amstrad, supports full motion video and is designed from standard digital signal processing chips. GEC and Amstrad are looking for more partners and are believed to have asked operators BT and Mercury to support the introduction of consumer video phones. It may be necessary to accommodate the video signals in the exchange. While BT is keen to promote the introduction of business ISDN phones, it does accept the possibility of a consumer version. Sugar is talking to the right people. GPT, through its contact with BT, probably knows as much about data compression as anyone in the world. Maybe he can work a little magic and turn that expertise into the consumer electronics success story the British electronics industry so badly needs.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kilohertz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England. 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England. 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Another telecommunications story. Redwood, that's the Minister for the DTI, reveals requests for new network licenses. 9 companies have applied for licenses to operate telecommunications networks following the end of the duopoly between British Telecom and Mercury, and some of the 7 companies you may have heard of. Cognito Group Limited want to provide radio packet data links. Ionica L3 Limited want to provide national telephone services based on fixed wireless communication. Meteor Communications wants to do telemetry and telecontrol systems by means of a Meteor Burst radio network. National Telecommunications Limited wants to provide broadband network services in the UK for vision, sound and data. PacNet are interested in fixed and mobile data services. RAM Mobile Data are also interested in packet switched data services. Satellite Information Services, provision of two-way satellite circuits connected to the public switched telephone network for engineering and program control purposes and in common with outside broadcasts activities. And Sound Broadcast Services, provision of point-to-point radio and wire systems for radio broadcasters to allow transmission of program material, communications and data to and from studios and transmitter links on a permanent basis. Mr. Redwood added, in addition, over 20 other companies have expressed a strong interest in running a new network, but they have yet to make a formal application. Here's a letter from France. Lafon Bruno lives in Sens, which is near Paris. I like DXing, he writes. I listened to you for 2 months. I like pop music. He listens on a Sony 2001D with a telescopic antenna. He likes the DX information, rock music, and he says it's marvellous and sends his félicitations. What a wonderful word. Well, thanks a lot, Bruno, for writing. This week on Sparks, we interview Peter Chicago, a man who needs no introduction. Alan Sugar wants a consumer video phone for £500. Can Amstrad and GEC Marconi make it practical? Hospital radio on FM, chart fiddling, and PAL Plus, a new TV standard that could lead Europe towards high-definition television. We've had a letter from the DTI, and of course there's lots more of your letters to come in Sparks.
A book review, Meters to Microwaves, British Development of Active Components for Radar Systems, 1937 to 1944. Reviewed in the IEEE's Electronics and Communications Engineering Journal. Meters to Microwaves makes an important contribution to the placing on record of the brilliant work carried out in the United Kingdom on the development of components for radar applications during the period from the mid-1930s until the end of World War II. During this period, engineers and scientists from very diverse disciplines came together to concentrate on the development of electronics for national defence. Although the book is concerned primarily with the British development of active components radar systems, the circumstances of these developments reflect the more general scientific, technological, and sociological successes achieved in Britain at a most crucial phase in our history. A factor which emerges very clearly is that the suites of active components required for centimetre radar were not produced at random, but were the result of a systematic search for solutions to defined operational problems. Brian Kallick's account is of especial interest to those of us who received much of our early experience in electronics through the dissection of war surplus radar, communications, and electronic countermeasures equipment. Here are described in detail such familiar friends as the SP-61 and EF-50 RF pentodes, which, together with the well-known VCR-97 cathode ray tube, form the basis for so many home-built post-war TV sets. Also included is the British CV-67 range of S-band klystrons, used as local oscillators in H2S and ASV, as well as the United States 732A and B 3cm reflex klystron, surely one of the most brilliant and audacious applications of American production engineering to the mass production of a sophisticated microwave component, which had only a year or so before been regarded as an esoteric laboratory curiosity, and which, like the silicon microwave mixer diode developed by BTH in the United Kingdom, is still to be found in service in some of the older commercial marine navigation radars. Fortunately, examples of many of these important components are preserved in several collections of electronic items of special historical interest. Those who visited the 1990 Military Microwaves exhibition at Wembley will have seen many of them in the excellent exhibit contributed by Mr. Rodney Berman from his personal collection of historic electron tubes, and in an adjoining exhibit by the Communications and Electronics Museum, which featured a working exhibit of the Rebecca homing aid from 1943, prepared by this reviewer. It is pleasing to see mentioned the important contributions made to radar development by the French radar pioneer, Henri Gluton, especially that of the large area oxide cathode for magnetrons. Inevitably, in a book of such wide scope, there are one or two devices, descriptions of which are omitted, but which are of interest, such as the CV-73 tetrode used in H2S, and the CV-6, / VR-135 VHF triode, which was produced both in the United Kingdom and the USA in very large numbers, and used in IFF Mark II and Mark III. Also not described is the low-power magnetron, replaced by a Heil tube in later sets, which was used as the transmitting oscillator in the famous No. 10 set, the 12-channel pulse-width modulated microwave link upon which General Montgomery depended for secure field communications during the closing stages of the war in Europe. There are remarkably few typographical errors, most of which are obvious in any case. In summary, Brian Kallick has written an important and readable account of the British development of a range of active components, without which the outcome of World War II might have been very different, and which laid the foundation for the successful development of radar and communications technologies, up to the present time. His book can be recommended to those studying electronics and communications engineering, as well as to the practicing engineer. It will also be of interest to the student of the history of technology, as well as to those who are fascinated by the way in which able people in Britain were able to come together in common purpose to provide in such a short time the technological means by which the Allied successes in World War II were achieved. That review by R.M. Trim of a book called Meters to Microwaves, British Developments of Active Components for Radar Systems 1937-1944, written by E.B. Kallick and published by Peter Peregrinus. The price is an astonishing £38. If you can't afford that, you could try ordering it from your local library. They won't have it, but they will probably order it for you for a fairly nominal fee, and they'll get it in a week or two from the British Library, unless somebody else has beaten you to it.
When I grow up, when I grow up, I wanna be an old woman. Oh, an old, no, 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 an old, old woman. And then I think I'm gonna find myself an old man. And I think I'm gonna marry myself that old man. I know, I know, I know, I know the really old man. We're gonna have 120 babies. 105, 10, 15, 20 babies. That's what I said, 120, baby. We'll raise them on tiger's milk and green banana. Mangoes and coconuts and watermelon. We're gonna give them that watermelon when they start to yell. Summer, we'll sit in a field and watch the sun melt. In the winter, we'll sit by a fire and watch the moon freeze. Me, my old man, and 120 babies. Me, my old man, and 120 babies. Bye.
The subject of the putative change to single sideband broadcasting for shortwave came up recently on Radio Netherlands' programme Media Network.
It's interesting to note that it's been mainly the smaller countries in Europe that have been the most active with single sideband tests. Norway and Sweden, for instance, alongside Holland. At a recent meeting in Washington, D.C., John Tusa, the managing director of the BBC World Service, referred to a recent survey they'd done in India. From that, the BBC concludes that it's not worth their while changing over to SSB. By the time they do, there may be better technology. This view is echoed by audio design engineer Trevor Brook, who runs the technical shortwave station from Ireland called Radio Facts.
I'm completely sceptical about the future of single sideband for broadcasting. It's been talked about at international conferences for 20 years, maybe longer, and there are plans for broadcasters to switch over in the long term to first of all compatible single sideband and then single sideband with very much reduced carrier, and I just don't believe it will happen. The compatibility problem for existing AM envelope detector receivers is just unacceptable. The distortion figures are too high, the reduction in loudness for the listener is just too great a penalty. Broadcasters will not put up with it, and they won't stop using AM. What will happen is that there will be increased use of dynamic carrier control, the BBC technique, or this alternative DAM technique to save electricity bills, so that people can either use the transmitter to run the same power and save electricity bill, or you can run the same electricity bill and run slightly more power from the same transmitter and aerial power rating. I don't think people will go to single sideband to any large extent. A few broadcasters will, and they'll sit there on a few channels which are fairly clear using single sideband, and the enthusiasts and the monitoring services will use those feeds. But the bulk of listening will, I'm convinced, will always stay on AM until we go to something totally different like satellite or digital.
When you say digital, you mean digital via HF?
I don't think that will really happen. I think digital, when it happens, will be a satellite feed. And there are proposals for allocating spectrum space, and international broadcasters will be on those satellites. It will be a big boys' game, though. There probably won't be feeds which can be rented by the smaller stations. They will be stuck on shortwave or on just local satellite vision subcarriers.
You mentioned that SSB is going to be a hard slog if it happens at all. On the other hand, can AM be improved further? In other words, AM receiver design?
Yes, there's not much more the transmitting stations can do on AM. The receiver designer can clean up the distortion of the receiver. They can clean up the filtering. But on the whole, there's not any great step forwards to be seen. No, there's progress is going to be slow from now on. There's nothing dramatic going to happen.
Well, Holland's neighbour to the east is also looking into single sideband. Major refurbishment work is going on at Deutsche Welle's Jülich transmitter site, west of Cologne, very near to the Dutch border. The new 100 kilowatt transmitters going in are all capable of compatible single sideband operation. But Peter Singer, who heads Deutsche Welle's RF department in Cologne, cautions that the switchover will be gradual, if at all.
We think SSB single sideband would be a solution for the future if the receivers are available in the whole world, and of course if all the transmitters can broadcast SSB.
So at the moment they're not, so you're not starting them.
We have a daily SSB transmission on 6140 kilohertz, and we are following up the development of the receivers. And when our listeners in the developing countries have got the possibility to buy such type of receiver, which is easy to handle and easy to tune, then we would change slowly to SSB.
Do I interpret that as pessimism then? I mean, it's going to be a long time before you can make a good, stable SSB receiver for, let's say, $50.
Well, it's not pessimism, but you should consider that we are broadcasting for listeners and not for ourselves or for the receiver industry. So when our listeners have the equipment available, then we will also be ready to broadcast single sideband.
Peter Zenger.
Jan Willem Drexager of Radio Netherlands is more optimistic.
I think it'll make a chance. as long as the receiver manufacturers will follow these receivers which are suitable for single sideband reception. It would be very good if receiver manufacturers will introduce synchronous detectors in their receivers. And, well, of course, you always get the chicken and the egg problem. When the broadcasters don't start with transmitting single sideband, the receiver manufacturers will not produce those kind of receivers. So that's actually one of the reasons we like to continue with this single sideband, so that there are some single sideband broadcasts present in the spectrum.
And experience with the new technology is always useful.
Jonathan Marks there with Media Network from Radio Netherlands. And there is one absolutely fundamental problem technically with single sideband for broadcast use, which is the complete lack of any system of AGC. No one has really thought this one through properly. When you've got an AM station, you have an AGC system using the carrier to set the gain in the receiver. If you're using single sideband with 6 dB reduced carrier, you've still got a carrier you can use to set the gain in the receiver. With the proposed system which broadcasters are supposed to change to, according to international agreement, sometime in the future, the carrier is going to be reduced to such a level that the receiver cannot rely on using that carrier to set the receiver's gain. It has therefore to rely on using the audio level. That then means that during a pause in programming, your receiver is going to decide to increase the gain. The result of that is a reduced subjective signal-to-noise ratio. Every pause in transmission, the receiver gain will suck up. It will sound like the cheap sort of audio gain controls we have on domestic cassette recorders 10 years ago. Will the public put up with this kind of nonsense? I don't think so. So I think we'll stay with large carriers all over the bands and AM.
I don't see an easy way around that either. Amazing that no one's thought it through properly, despite the international discussions and many articles published on the subject of SSB broadcasting. Well, this is Sparks on Radiofax, 6205 and 12255. Here's a letter from New Zealand, Western Oamaru. Peter Grenfell writes, "Good to hear Radiofax again, although it was tough going to log. Wish you all the best in 1992 and the future, and thank you kindly for your QSL on 6205. That was him listening on 12255 on an R5000 with 100 feet north to south, 30 feet high of antenna. That's Peter Grenfell writing all the way from New Zealand.
About 19. She said,
16 years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie. Jackie. Jackie.
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs,
from houseboats on the river Thames to office blocks in town, close enough to really care as great should always be. London's favourite station, Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
I'm so happy to be here tonight. So glad to be in your wonderful city. And I have a little message for you. And I want to tell every woman and every man tonight that's ever needed someone to love, that's ever had somebody to love, that's ever had somebody to understand, that's ever had someone that needs your love all the time, someone that's with them when they're up, somebody that's with them when they're down. If you had yourself somebody like this, you better hold on to them. So let me tell you something. Sometimes you get what you want, and you lose what you have. And there's a song I sing, and I believe if everybody was to sing this song, you'd say the whole world. Listen to me. Everybody needs.
is the reply to our latest letter to the Radio Communications Agency, the Department of Trade and Industry. It is indeed the case that ministers wish to see the fullest possible use being made of the radio spectrum within the terms of the Broadcasting and Wireless Telegraphy Acts and other relevant legislation, and in particular are keen to encourage an expansion of authorised sound broadcasting in this country. I must, however, advise you clearly about the legal position on broadcasts you imply you have made. The frequencies listed in the information slip attached to your letter are in bands reserved for the maritime mobile service and the fixed service, which includes some use by the maritime mobile service. They are not available for broadcasting and must not be used for this purpose. Moreover, any unauthorised broadcasts within UK boundaries, whether or not in the broadcasting bans, will be vigorously pursued by this agency and may result in prosecution and seizure of equipment. If unauthorised broadcasts are being made to the UK from any other country, we shall be obliged to pursue the matter with the authorities of that country. So far as the authorisation of new stations in the UK is concerned, independent stations are licensed under the Broadcasting Act by the Radio Authority, but only on frequencies assigned to the authority. The expansion of independent broadcasting is focused on the VHF and MF bands. The authority does not have any powers to license stations in the HF bands, so there is currently no mechanism by which you could transmit legally in the HF broadcasting bands. It is for the Home Secretary to decide whether independent sector broadcasting might be extended to HF broadcasting bands. Technically, the bands are not very suitable for domestic broadcasting. Less than 3% of HF broadcasting operations around the world are devoted to domestic coverage. In these circumstances, I do not feel I can encourage your proposals. However, I have passed your papers to the Home Office Broadcasting Department, who will no doubt contact you if the use of the HF bands is extended to independent broadcasters. You may also wish to contact the Radio Authority to discuss your future plans. From M.J. Mitchell, he's the Chief Executive of the Radio Communications Agency. Well, that's in stark contrast to a letter we received recently from Cheltenham in Gloucestershire from Jennifer Jones. It was interesting, or should I say predictable, that sooner or later Radiofax would receive allegations of interference from the DTI, and also some veiled threats against their arch-enemy Radio Caroline. Whilst I would agree with the DTI about out-of-band broadcasting, I thought it would be interesting to see how many other stations, if any, were also broadcasting in the maritime mobile band, 6200 kHz to 6525. I checked this band at 20:30 hours BST tonight, the 29th of September, and logged no less than 9 stations broadcasting in this part of the spectrum. Apart from Radiofax on 6205 kHz, there were 2 other unlicensed stations, Radio Merlin on 6240 kHz and Radio Harmony on 6305 kHz. The other 6 stations logged were broadcasting at much higher power levels than the 3 just mentioned. These were logged on 6200 kHz, 6230 kHz, Radio Vatican on 6245 kHz, 6265 kHz, 6280 kHz, and the last one on 6334 kHz. On previous evenings, Radio Tirana, Albania, has been logged on 6218 kHz, and a German numbers station on 6200 kHz. There has also been a contribution from Radio Moscow on 6215 kHz, but at a much weaker signal strength than their normal output on other frequencies. One wonders if the DTI have also complained about all these other stations just mentioned, and if so, why are they still broadcasting? Perhaps they haven't made any complaints at all. If this is the case, why not? It is interesting to note that according to the DTI's own published information, the following should be noted. quote, on condition that harmful interference is not caused to the maritime mobile service, the band's 6200 kHz to 6213.5 kHz and 6200.5 kHz to 6525 kHz may be used exceptionally by stations in the fixed service communicating only within the boundary of their country in which they're located, with a mean power not exceeding 50 watts, unquote. Whilst Radiofax or Vatican Radio does not fall into this category, it does suggest that these frequencies are not of a high priority or emergency nature. The band of frequencies used by English-speaking maritime mobile stations appears to be between 6218.6 and 6224 kHz. Perhaps it should be mentioned that according to British Telecom International Maritime, quote, it is the duty of radio operators in the maritime mobile service to report to the Department of Trade and Industry through their employers any infringements of the radio regulations which they may detect, unquote. Note the use of the word infringements. This does not mean that any interference has been caused, or the infringement was even on a frequency used by the ship's radio operator. On the other hand, there may be a genuine case of interference to one side of a conversation on a non-emergency channel. The DTI will not differentiate between infringements and interference. They will claim a case of interference every time. Ships at sea have a number of working frequencies, including VHF and the Maritime Mobile Satellite Service for emergency traffic. Some comparisons have been made to government-run out-of-band broadcasting, for example, the BBC World Service. Let us examine just two of the frequencies used by the BBC World Service. These are 7325 kHz and 15070 kHz. The former frequency falls in a non-broadcast part of the spectrum allocated to fixed and land mobile. The latter frequency, 15070, is located in a non-broadcast part of the spectrum allocated to aeronautical mobile, military, etc. This information comes from the DTI's own publications and is confirmed by the International Telecommunications Union. So what is the DTI doing about this disgraceful situation? Not very much, it seems. It is also known that the 7325 Daventry transmitter has been intermodulating with another utility station and causing interference in the Corby area of Northamptonshire. A number of radio amateurs complained to the DTI's Leicester office, and the interference was confirmed by the DTI. But what did the DTI do about all this? Absolutely nothing. Could this really be the same DTI, the guardians of the radio spectrum, that are so keen to stamp out unauthorised broadcasting that they will spend tens of thousands of pounds of taxpayers' money chasing radio ships in the international waters of the North Sea? The listener could be forgiven in thinking that there is a double standard going on here. It was also interesting to note that when Atlantic 252 first came on air, one of the first complaints was ex-DTI Minister John Butcher. Obviously, it takes a very special kind of person to be a DTI man, or even an ex-DTI man. But not only is Atlantic 252 completely legitimate, it is part-owned by the Irish state broadcasting company RTE. Perhaps Mr. Butcher and co. just didn't like the competition, especially when they had their own vastly overpriced radio stations to sell in the months and years ahead. Whilst I don't agree with out-of-band broadcasting, the reality is that everyone else is doing it, including the BBC. Perhaps Radiofax should suggest to the DTI that they might want to put their own house in order before they start complaining about anyone else. Writing from Cheltenham, someone who definitely knows what they're talking about, Jennifer Jones. She also includes a photocopied page of Monitoring Times with some indications of what the marine mobile people get up to. on 2738 kilohertz is logged possible fishing vessels using the F word frequently. Newfoundland accents at 1850 in USB. And on 6300 at 0221 in upper sideband, fishing boats talking about smoking good Mexican weed. And they also talked about their friends who would travel to Key West, who would pick up men in gay bars. They would then take them home and tie them up and rob them, and made $10,000 a weekend. However, they had to leave when their pictures got plastered all over the local newspapers. Emergency broadcasts indeed.
Up. Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcast in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen, Tony Prince in 1966, other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s, and you'll hear too memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, PO Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, PO Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, The Legend Lives On.
You're listening to Sparks from Radio Facts. Fresh programs start on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. More letters later on in the programme. Also, in a few minutes, we interview Peter Chicago and find out the latest from the world of Radio Caroline. From New Scientist, homework clears the air. Working at home with a computer linked to the office, or telecommuting, could help cities such as Los Angeles to beat their smog problem, says a researcher from the University of California. There has long been a theory that modern telecommuting would reduce the distance people travel, but skeptics argued that people often ran errands while they were traveling between home and work or during office hours, so a saving in the number of work journeys would be at least partially offset by a rise in other types of journey. The state of California's telecommuting experiment gave Ryuichi Kitamura, professor of civil engineering, a unique opportunity to find out who was right. Commuters were asked to fill in a 3-day travel diary in 1988, before the telecommuting experiment started. They recorded details of how, why, and where they traveled. The survey was then repeated with the same subjects after they began working from home. On average, people were making about 4 journeys a day before the experiment began, and a control group continued the same pattern after it had started. Those who worked from home halved the number of journeys they made. On average, they travelled 75 kilometres less every day, about 80% of the distance they had previously travelled. Telecommuters also made no more journeys outside the rush hours than the control group did. The biggest reduction in travel took place during rush hours, and telecommuters used freeways less than those in the control group. But although telecommuting could cut congestion, it also cut the use of public transport. If telecommuters had previously used public transport at all, it was for getting to or from work. That piece from New Scientist.
Two short items. From On Air, the official journal of the National Association of Hospital Broadcasting Organisations, Red Hill, first to broadcast on FM. Hospital Radio Red Hill is to be the first of a new wave of hospital radio stations who will be using low-powered FM transmitters to broadcast their programmes. The long-awaited announcement means that the station, broadcasting to the Red Hill Hospital on Earlswood Common, will start its experimental transmissions late this year. If the Department of Trade and Industry, Hospital Management, NARBO and Home Office technical staff are satisfied with the first test signal reports, it is expected that the association will be able to start issuing licenses to member stations. It is anticipated that the majority of hospital radio stations will be using the same national frequency, thought to be 87.6 MHz. And Zapped Pirate from International Broadcasting. American Cablevision zapped pirate viewers of its premium services early this year by using a worm program to disable illegally adapted cable boxes. The worm, written by cable box maker General Instrument, blows the relevant ROM chips in the box that make the piracy possible. Some 200 pirates took their boxes in to be repaired and were slapped with $5,000 fines for their trouble.
Lipo, fatty, lipo, fatty, fatty.